Corporate America is all around us. Do you want to be on the inside? If so, how does one survive? We'll discuss this and much more on this edition of Frank Relationships.
You're listening to Frank Relationships with Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Yes, those are my babies. As always, thanks for getting daddy started today. Mwah. Corporate America veteran and certified life coach Lanahl Harris is with us today, and I am curious. If you're going into corporate America, what do you need to know and keep in mind?
So if you're going into corporate America, there's a whole lot you need to know. And I think first and foremost, you need to know what it is that you want to accomplish. Mm-hmm. So what's your vision more than anything? Why are you going? And consider that it's for much more than a paycheck. Because if it's just for a paycheck, you may find yourself wanting. That's the very first thing I would say. Mm-hmm. And then in regards to what you need to know, I think they need to stick around for the next hour, because that is going to probably take about the hour for me to share with your listeners exactly what they need to know.
What else is there to get from a corporate life than a paycheck?
I would say a lot of experience. Today I'm an entrepreneur, and I would not be as successful as an entrepreneur if I hadn't learned the lessons about running a business that I learned in corporate America. You know, so when we think corporate America, a lot of times we think, you know, hardcore, cold. Sometimes we think big, evil corporation. Mm-hmm. And I'm not here to say whether that's true or not. Mm-hmm. But what I will tell you is they know how to run a business. And so one of the major lessons that I've learned is how to run a business and how to be successful running a business as an entrepreneur. So that's one of the best lessons I learned from corporate America.
Did you read a book called The E-Myth? Are you familiar with that?
I am.
All right. And one of the things that comes to mind when you say what you just said is, I forget the author's name, but he talks about basically do a task, document that task, give it to somebody else to do. And then I think there's an assessment part in terms of evaluate how well they're doing it. Something, but it's been some years since I've read it. But the main point that I took from it is do the task, document what it takes to do it. And I can imagine corporations do a great job with that. Would you concur?
I would concur. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably one of the first things you learn in corporate America as a leader is your job is to document everything. Document what you tell your employee to do, and then document how well they did. Mm-hmm. And you know, you have that, you know, I think we're all familiar with the annual review that most of us get at the beginning of the year in corporate America. Mm-hmm. But all of that is about documentation and really identifying how the people that work for you are doing. So I think Michael Gerber, more than likely, he got a lot of that from his own experience in corporate America, the author of The E-Myth.
Yeah. Welcome to Frank Relationships, a show for you, my brethren, who, like me, are too young to be considered old and too old to be considered young. It's also for those of you who love and support us. We're here to provide weekly wisdom, conversation, and the information that'll help you create loving and flexible parents and partners. I'm Frank Love, and you can find me, my blog, and my various social media incarnations at franklove.com. If you're listening to the show on Blog Talk Radio, please follow us, and then via iTunes, please subscribe so that you can effortlessly get the show each week. Did I say effortlessly or did I say something crazy?
You said effortlessly. You just didn't say it
effortlessly.
Effortlessly.
Gotcha. All right. Also, if you're enjoying the show, and of course you are, please give us a favorable iTunes rating and please share it with your family and friends on your favorite social media platform. We're always looking for new social media friends, so please help us help our communities by spreading the word about the show. In my own special way, I've already introduced you by asking you that question. But anyway,
your
for those of you...
special way.
Yes.
Mercy greeting, on my soul.
Greetings to my special super-duper co-host,
goodness.
Nancy Goldring.
Hi, Frank.
Hey, hey.
How are you?
I'm great.
Awesome.
She is the consummate generalist. She is beautiful, and she's wise, and she's here hanging out with us today.
Thank you.
Today's guest is a global entrepreneur, blogger, and radio show host. He's also a former corporate vice president and chief diversity officer. During his tenure in corporate America, he developed his own unique perspectives and set of rules to play by in order to survive and thrive there. And some of them just may surprise you. So, if you, like me, want to know what the give and takes are for working in corporate America, if there's a racial factor to navigate, and when it may be time to leave, then stay tuned as your Frank relationship team talks life in corporate America, particularly as a black male with certified life coach and global entrepreneur, Lanal Harris. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Frank. Appreciate it. And good morning, Nancy.
Good morning.
Before we get too deep in today's subject matter, we're going to see what's going on in the news. So, Lanal, please don't be bashful. We want you to join in on the conversation.
Absolutely.
Okay. Researcher Dr. John Gottman has the following three research-based tips for that he's found in successful relationships. And I don't even want to get into what a successful relationship is. That's a...
debatable.
Yeah, that has its own offshoot. You know, there's a fork in the road right there we could take. But we can just go with some generally accepted whatever about what it is.
Okay.
One is express interest. So if your partner says something or is doing something, express an interest in it. And I think that is a very powerful note of wisdom, because we often are in our own worlds, and we may have a conversation. We may want to have a conversation. I may say something. I could say, that's an interesting painting on the wall. And if I say it next to my wife and she says nothing, I feel like I'm just
talking to the wall.
Yeah. I feel like I'm just left out there, like alone. Like she didn't care.
She didn't acknowledge what
said. Exactly.
It's personal. It's like she didn't acknowledge you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you for that tip. Now I know how to get that.
Yes, yeah.
I know how to make him cry.
You ain't even married. What are you talking about?
But I was.
Lanal, you're married, right?
I am, and I wholeheartedly agree. You got to express interest. As a matter of fact, if for some reason my wife feels like there's a disconnect, it's probably because I haven't expressed interest lately. Mm. I mean, in anything that she's up to, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, man. I have a woman whose first love language is quality time.
Uh-huh.
And so expressing interest is a normal, regular thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Mm. Mm.
He's in touch with that.
Nice.
His wife's primary love language.
You know,
I am.
It's funny that you brought that up, because I talked to my wife about a week ago, and we were having a conversation about our love languages. And I couldn't really... I was thinking how I appreciate all of when she does something that touches all of them, it really matters to me. And mind you, we interviewed Dr. Gary Chapman here on the show some time ago, and he says that you can be touched by all of them, but there's generally one that I think this is what he said. There's generally one that is really goes to the heart mm-hmm. of who you are. And yeah. I know, like, I love all of them. You know, I really do appreciate the quality time. I appreciate, and don't get me thinking that I can run off all five of them right now. So quality time, words of affirmation, acts of service,
yep.
stuff, meaning gifts.
Gifts, yeah.
And then there's another one that I don't remember.
Physical touch.
Physical touch. Yeah. I love some physical touch.
Okay. Yes.
So I'm glad to know that there are five segments that I can pay attention to. And I think it's beneficial to actually just pick one and show her something, some way of connecting with whichever one you want to pick. You know?
Well, from the outside looking in, Frank, I would have to say that you are definitely a quality time guy.
Seriously?
Yes. You're a quality time guy. You are a, and not exactly on the DL, you're also an acts of service guy. Yes. So now this is just, that may be your professional presence.
Mm-hmm.
I just find that the way you interact with your family, the amount of time that you give to your family life and a certain quality of family life, you make everything an event. You know, this notion of having, what did you call them? Room dates where you guys fold the laundry together and watch a movie. I mean, you just turn that into an opportunity to be together. You have 10,000 different things going on. And there are times when I'm at home saying, oh, I got to do this. And I'm thinking, you know what? Don't even get started. Don't even call Frank and say, I can't do this anymore. I'm overwhelmed. He's not going to want to hear it because he has 10,000 other things to do. He has a wife. He has a family. Just get it done. So, and yet I never feel from you the stress that I'm sure you, at least in my mind, you must feel sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow I feel that you soothe yourself, you balance the pressure with the quality of interaction you give to not just your family, but your friends too. How many times did I get a text over the summer? I know it's short notice, but we're having the barbecue, come on over. And I'm like, okay, but I got something else to do. But I thought it was such a powerful gesture, number one, that you would invite me
mm-hmm.
and that you were even doing it. I got this massive backyard. We have one barbecue a year, and trust me, I'm stressing with that one. So the quality time thing is huge for you. Acts of service is huge for you. I find that in engaging you myself, the magic answer is yes. Okay, Frank, you're right. I'm on it. You got it. I'm with it. As long as I'm saying yes now, God knows, behind the curtain, I'm just like, oh, hurry up. Make him happy. Just make him happy, and everything will be okay. And it's an effort. It's a skill that I'm developing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's the way you respond that keeps me in the game. It's the level of gratitude. And it's not huge or over the top, but it's consistent, it's believable, and it's radically and deeply appreciated. It makes it very, it's challenging, and yet it's just so easy.
You have blown.
Well, Nancy, it sounds like one of your love languages might be words of affirmation. Just listening to you and what resonates from Frank to you, I'm hearing words of affirmation. Might be one of your top two.
Wow. You blow my mind. Everything
really?
You just talked about me for 5 minutes.
Wow.
And you know, you have given a summary of me as you know, you experienced me, and it's all genuine. Like, it's really, I'm amazed. It's
the show is over, Lenore. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. I have won today.
And she knows the way to Frank's heart is through his ego.
So I try not to engage it at all.
But to add to what you're saying, you didn't even mention this, but there are times when I just pick up the phone and call you.
Yes, yes.
Just, hey.
Absolutely.
How you doing?
How you doing? And I'm like, I'm good.
She seems to think I want something.
Well, I that's because that's my... That's not you. That's me. Uh-huh. That's my listening. Mm-hmm. Most of the calls I get are from somebody who wants something. Uh-huh. So for somebody to just call me and kibitz with me is kind of like, okay. And I really, I don't want anybody who knows me to say, oh, you know, I call you, you don't answer the phone or whatever. Which is true. It's like you're always running, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm trying to end my battle with time, mm-hmm. and so mm-hmm. I'm not a kibitzer.
I've never heard that term ever, but I get what it is. I mean, I get the context.
It's Yiddish.
It's Yiddish. Yeah,
a joker.
Uh huh.
For me, it's just kind of like, you know,
to joke around talk, is the kibitz.
Yeah, uh-huh. play.
That
I am in person.
Uh huh.
And yet the telephone, not so much, not as much as I used to be.
Wow.
And yeah, not nearly as much as I used to be. So I don't mind it. I appreciate that you do it. It does catch me off guard most of the time, mm-hmm. but I certainly wouldn't discourage it.
Hmm. Well, admittedly, I love people.
Yeah.
And I love the people who I get a chance to just talk to and, you know, grow a relationship with.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. That's great. Damn. Well, we haven't even gotten to the other.
He's
two,
human, Lenore.
John.
We've probably done a gazillion shows, and the people are like, "Man, this guy."
The other two John Gottman pieces were "Be Gentle in Conflict" and "Repair Negative Interactions." I guess we can talk about that next week. I mean, we're not gonna take up the whole show about what's in the news. Wow, what? Okay, on to the meat and potatoes of the interview.
Okay,
Lenore, let's get to the good stuff.
All right.
How long were you in corporate America, and what exactly did you do?
So I was in corporate America 16 years,
mm-hmm.
And while I was in corporate America, I had the distinct privilege of working initially in call center operations, which led to me leading global operations for a few Fortune 500 companies. And then towards the end of my tenure in corporate America, I was a chief diversity officer. So I led diversity and inclusion for the last organization I worked for.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. And I assume that you don't, that you prefer not to say what companies.
Yeah, I prefer not to.
Okay,
I
all right.
Not to. Yep.
And what, mm-hmm. as a black corporate professional, what was your unique experience? Or even the one that you notice amongst other black corporate professionals that you were just a member of?
You know, I would say as a black corporate professional in the beginning, initially there was a culture shock. And what I mean by culture shock is when you get into corporate America, you begin to realize quickly that it's almost a game that has a different set of rules. And so immediately what may have worked, you know, culturally for us growing up in our interactions with people that we know. And when I'm saying culturally growing up, I'm talking about other black people, mm-hmm. other African Americans, whatever you may want to say.
Mm-hmm.
You quickly learn that, you know, that type of genuine interaction doesn't work in corporate America. So there's a shock initially, like, wow, you know, I can't necessarily be myself. I can't show up as myself. Otherwise, in some ways, that's kind of held against me. Mm-hmm. So initially, there was a culture shock. And the second big thing I noticed.
How long did it take you to figure that out, that it wasn't, you can't do that?
Probably, I'm a unique individual. So I'm very observant. Mm-hmm. And so for me, probably within the first 6 months, I realized, you know, me showing up here like I normally show up isn't going to work. I will not be successful. Mm. But it probably took another 6 months to figure out, like, how to do my best to try to fit in. And I say try to fit in because I would say I spent the 16 years of my career in corporate America trying to fit in and never really truly fitting in.
Which could go
from that perspective.
That go could ahead. Go to where one of the things I mentioned at the beginning of the show, knowing when it's time to leave.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm. I mean, that's part of the reason I left is mm-hmm. after having some success in corporate America, right? So going from an entry level position all the way up to the position of officer and executive of a Fortune 500 company with a $5 billion cap wireless company, mm-hmm. And still not feeling like I fit in, right? Playing the role of chief diversity officer and feeling like, man, this is still difficult. And that's when I decided, I'm like, you know what? I don't want to spend another 20, 25 years like this before retirement. This is not how I plan on spending my life. Mm-hmm. And so that's where it was like, all right, it's time to create a exit strategy and begin to build my own exclusively.
How does not fitting in look? How do you? How do you know this isn't for me in a way that you can succinctly say, but there is something else for me, or instead of just this isn't for me, life is doo-doo and you know that's just how it's going to be. How do you know the difference?
I think you know the difference in, well, okay, so fitting in right now, I think the listeners could say, hey, I've heard four voices, all of whom seem to be in some way in sync with one another, right? So there's a harmony of mm-hmm. sorts, mm-hmm. partly because as we're speaking, I don't believe any of us feel any inherent communication barriers, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One of the things that I experienced in corporate America as a black man was often a communication barrier, where here I am speaking plain English, but my colleagues aren't understanding what I'm trying to say. And part of it is because we all speak from a context, right? And so I had 20 to 22, 23 years of developing a particular context around how I communicate that I brought into corporate America and quickly found out that the majority of my peers had a different communication context.
Yeah.
And here I am trying to communicate with them, right? And when I say my different peers, you know, considering that corporate America is majority Caucasian, our white brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. You know, now trying to communicate, you know, automatically you begin to feel like I'm communicating wrong. Now, does that mean I'm communicating wrong or I'm communicating the way I know how to communicate?
Right. Mm-hmm.
But in the context of corporate America, if you want to be successful, you have to consider that you're communicating wrong and begin to identify immediately what are the right ways to communicate.
And what might that be, given you don't have that history?
So first and foremost, believe it or not, is accent and how you sound and how you articulate yourself are the very first communication barriers. Some of the advice I've given, you know, blacks who are looking to be successful in corporate America is the very first piece of advice of learn to articulate your words and speak proper English, speak the King's English, right? And you could say, wow, man, that is crazy. And people have been offended mm-hmm. when I
oh,
said
sure.
it, right?
Sure.
But if you can't articulate yourself without their accent, immediately it puts up a barrier because you're not saying the words right. I'll give you a perfect example. One of the words I didn't say right when I first entered corporate America was the word ask, right? A-S-K.
Oh, we tend to say X.
Yeah, X. Right. Like, I put an X on it. and that's something that most, I would say, I don't want to generalize, but, you know, we as blacks, we tend to, you know, shorten words, abbreviate things in our English. Mm-hmm. It's just a part of how we grow up and how we've learned the language, and it's been passed down over time. But when you move into a corporate environment, that little small word is something that can trip up the ears of a peer, and immediately they look at you as if you are not as intelligent, mm-hmm. or you don't understand the material the same, right? Which is far from the case. Mm-hmm. But one of the things about corporate America is you're not just there to be competent. You're also there to perform. And the performance is a huge part of your success. And what I mean by performance, you might think, well, are you talking productivity, Linnell? No, I'm talking about performing. Like, how do you show up? What do you look like? How do you sound? You are performing. And as soon as you can figure out that you're performing, that's part of the first key to being successful. And that's one of the things I experienced early on. And I figured out, which I believe helped me be successful.
Wow.
Code switching.
Good night. How did you figure out that you said X wrong? And or
oh, sometimes I don't even want to say it wrong. In the listener's face.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
So what,
you know, because if I'm mm-hmm. if I'm in a situation where, let's say, the pool is mixed in terms of culture, mm-hmm. and we're all talking, and maybe another African American person uses the vernacular, mm-hmm. it kind of gets this glazed. Oh, you can just see it. It's sort of like Linnell is saying, you have to be observant, mm-hmm. but it can be witnessed. And I know for myself, going back and forth between communities, I find that my diction is lazy in a way. And sometimes I'll listen to mm-hmm. myself being recorded and I'm like, oh, there you go. Right. And yet you have, the thing is, it's sort of like a double-edged sword, because if I were from another country, mm-hmm. some of that would be tolerated mm-hmm. differently. Mm-hmm. My intellectual capacities would not necessarily be called into question. But even though I'm from another culture, I am born and raised in this country, so the expectation is a little different.
Wow.
You hit it on the head. You hit it on the head.
What you got, Jeff?
I'll add another element in, and obviously I don't have as much pigment as you guys.
Well, yeah, and before you even say that, there's a few things I want to preface my understanding of Jeff. Jeff is the engineer of the show. He's also a white male who spent a significant amount of time around black people. But you've also been in corporate America, but not as a, you know, you
well, yeah, if you want to give the, I grew up in a mixed neighborhood,
right,
in New York, and then spent a considerable amount of my career in black media. Mm-hmm. I worked at BET. I worked for a record company in the R&B division. So a lot of the things that I've experienced and been exposed, for instance, I told you the story, I used to, around 5 o'clock every night, have to go downstairs and hail cabs for my coworkers.
Damn. Yeah.
You know, that kind of perception.
Wow.
But what I'm about to mention, and again, may sound odd coming from someone pigmentally challenged like myself. There was a gentleman named Mal Good. Mm-hmm. Mal Good was, if not the first, one of the first African-American network reporters. He worked for ABC. Mm-hmm. Extremely well-spoken. James Earl Jones-ish.
Okay.
Very authoritative, very credible, very trustworthy. And he was addressing a group of students, mostly college students, mostly African-American. And it has to do with responsibility. And what he said was, and this is true in a lot of different walks of professional life, someone like Spike Lee can attest to it as well, you are not just being judged on what you do
on yourself. You're representing an entire culture. Mm-hmm. So
yes.
You don't ask a question. You don't be going somewhere because the people who are hearing that are going to associate that with everyone on the block who looks like you, who says that. You're doing a disservice. You're not talking white. You're not selling out. You know, it got a little bit more dicey in the 90s where hip-hop culture became successful and a great way to make money. Mm-hmm. And there are people like Puff Daddy, like Jay-Z, who did not diminish their cultural roots in order to succeed. In fact, it was embraced. Mm-hmm. But you can count those icons on two hands, whereas there are millions of African Americans who are accepted into society, but more importantly, successful in society, just because they're articulate, smart, intelligent. Now, saying we be or, you know, what had happened was, or any of the things that might be considered ebonically correct, that doesn't mean you're not intelligent. But I only know that because I've lived with it. Go outside and see someone else who looks like me, because I look like a cop. That's not going to be that's not going to be their perception. So as long as you, African-American society, are aware of that, like Nancy said, I turn it on, I turn it off. Sometimes you don't even know it. And then he got into the N-word and, you know, a bunch of other stuff like that. But to the point, it is about responsibility, perception, and association.
Interesting. I worked for a nonprofit, a national nonprofit, a national health agency. That was about 15 years ago. And I had some, I invited some of my frat brothers out. This was amazing. I mean, I still get doo-doo for this when I'm fraternizing right now. But I invited them out to an event, and I was running the event, and they were helping. And they clowned me so bad for it. They were like, ho, 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 ho.
What? What
listen to Yao.
Oh, my goodness.
Listen to him in his
professional voice. That's what my dad
pontificated.
Yes. My dad called me at work one time. I answered the phone. I was working for a tax accounting firm in New York, and I answer, and he says,
"Who is that,
baby? Is that you?" And I said, "Hey." He says, "Oh, that's your Enron voice."
That's right.
And absolutely. I was like, yes. Oh, my goodness. It was so comical.
We calling each other on our...
It was your Enron voice, you know? So you wear different clothes for different occasions. You can do the same with the way you modify your tone and your voice.
What about, in fact, speaking of tone and the voice, what about just the bass in your voice? Is it necessary to remove the bass in your voice when you're in a corporate environment?
Well, so I think there's a number of different ways to remove the bass, right? You can listen to my voice right now.
I'm listening to
it'd be very difficult for me to remove the bass in my voice on a regular basis, right? So part of what I did is I began to realize that it's funny, I'm not even that big of a guy, but as a 6 foot tall, you know, well built black man, I had to, in some way, soften, you know, my presence.
Right.
And so what I found is that kind of taking on a Clark Kent approach and wearing glasses did that. And so
even though you didn't need them,
go ahead.
Do you need glasses?
I did, but I preferred to wear contacts.
Okay.
But what I found is that the reception I received when people met me for the first time when I had on glasses was much softer, and it seemed to, you know, there seemed to be more connection than when I didn't have on glasses.
You were more
approachable. And so I started wearing glasses to every corporate event, meetings, et cetera. And I did that probably after being in corporate America a year or two. Mm-hmm. So for the next 14 years, I wore glasses.
Whoa, the game is real.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It is real. And that's one of the reasons I say, you know, as Black Americans, we have to work twice as hard. You know, some of the work is just not in showing up competent and providing, being productive and providing good, solid work, right? There's a lot of preparation. There's a lot of thinking. There's a lot of strategy that must go into being successful in corporate America. Otherwise, you will find yourself wanting and trying to figure out why you're not advancing. And it could be very subtle things like this.
Very.
It's funny when you're the things, some of the things that you're pointing out, and even that I think about. And I read an article about a family of, it's an African-American family that has taught their boys that it's to avoid getting shot by the police. It's better to wear a collared shirt when you walk out of the house. And
absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. I hear kind of the same needed preparation when you get dressed in the morning. That's kind of what you're talking about. So we're talking about corporate America, but we're also talking about just life, in some ways, life on the streets.
Yeah. Well, I love that you said that, Frank, because when, as a chief diversity officer, when I would have someone in my office, typically a person of color, and they were in some ways asking for advice or complaining about their current circumstance, you know, often I would say is, hey, you know, where did you grow up, right? And I'm from Chicago. Mm-hmm. And if they said the South Side or the West Side, I'm like, the first mistake you're making is thinking that this is not the same game that you had to play growing up on the streets to survive. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the exact same game. Corporate America, consider corporate America, is the streets. And it was almost like a light bulb would go off for him. Like, wow. Like, you're not safe.
Right.
You're always under attack. So as soon as you show up here, consider that you are in the street. How would you conduct yourself? And immediately, there was a context shift for them. And they're like, okay, I get it. I need to thoroughly prepare every day to walk in this building. And I would say you're absolutely correct. You would not run outside without thinking, okay, what time of the day it is? Who might be out there? Who's running the corner right now? Should I be on that corner? Same thing in corporate America. What time should I show up? Who might see me? What meetings do I have today? How should I dress? It's no different, the preparation. And so often a light bulb will go off. And I think some of us make the mistake of thinking, oh, I've arrived. I've graduated college. I have my master's degree. That should be proof enough. And we show up and sit down, and then we're confused when we're not accepted.
Speaking of mistakes, what are some of the top mistakes that you find that occur when you see Black professionals in the corporate world? Or that may prevent a Black individual from becoming a quote-unquote professional in the corporate world.
Okay. Well, so first and foremost, I know you have a relationship show, and so I'll keep it real. I'm going to speak to my brothers.
Hit it.
Is one of the biggest mistakes I've seen Black male professionals make is being frivolous in their fraternizing with female coworkers. Mm. It's a huge mistake. Mm-hmm. Again, you have to remember, we're not playing on a level field, right? Mm-hmm. So just because you see your colleague doing that, you see mm-hmm. him going to lunch with multiple, you know, women, seems like he's having a great experience in his corporate life, mm-hmm. doesn't mean that you can go and replicate that without getting scarred. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. that's one of the biggest mistakes I've seen, you know, some of my brothers make in corporate America. And then later, they're trying to figure out how I didn't. Is that really sexual harassment?
Mm.
And it's kind of like, you know, why am I the one under the, you know, kind of under the scope or losing my job for sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, as an HR professional, sexual harassment is real simple. If you get involved with a woman at work and she says, "We're done," and you text or call her after she said, "We're done," and she can prove that, that is sexual harassment, and your career in that organization is now over.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Does it work both ways? Might it be the same?
Of course not. Don't be absurd. If you say it's done, it's not done. Until I say it's done, and then it's done. So you hear Lenol. You hear him chuckling.
I have yet. I spent 16 years in corporate America. The majority of that in leadership, I did not experience a male winning a sexual harassment case in my tenure.
Were there any?
I did.
Were there any sexual harassment cases?
There were some claims
from males,
but they didn't go far.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So I want to interject something. And you talked about papers, books. I just started listening to this book. And essentially, it's given me a different way to see working in corporate America. So the book is called The End of Jobs. Mm. And
Jobs, employment, jobs, or Steve Jobs?
No, mm-hmm. No, The End of Jobs, mm-hmm. Okay? Yep. So I feel, by virtue of just being a few chapters into it, that we are no longer in a position, no one is, and trust me, if no one is, then the African American community definitely is not in a position where we can think that if we go to school, get an advanced degree, and a position in a corporate environment, that we have, we can kind of just kick back and let it roll from there. And I say that from a variety of different perspectives. Number one, that's not what they are doing anymore. One of my favorite questions is always a question I never acknowledge asking ever to anyone is, where are the white people? So if I find that my people are suddenly doing, or another culture of people is suddenly doing what only white people used to do, mm-hmm. then I'm saying, okay, so where are they? This is no longer attractive to them. This is no longer of value to them. Where are they? What are they doing? So once upon a time, only young white kids used to wait tables. Mm-hmm. Not the case anymore. I think I first noticed
I thought that was the other way around, that young white kids did not wait tables.
Oh, no. They wait tables.
Or that it was
tables.
Just black people. Because, we're talking about a history of slavery. And
no, we ain't talking about slavery when you can get $20 tip for serving a meal, and at the end of the night, you can go home with a couple of $100 in your pocket for maybe 4 to 6 hours of work. And you probably only have to work the weekend, and you can spend the rest of the time at school where your African-American counterpart is somewhere clocking, dollars for hours only. Mm-hmm. So yep. He's carrying buckets, and you're laying a pipeline for water over time. Mm-hmm. So, and yep. that's straight out of, that book? Rich Dad, Poor Dad, right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So yep. that's one thing. So the other thing is that I heard last week on my way here an announcer referring to today's economy as the gig economy, which means that people are making ends meet with a variety of different
income streams.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Not, and so for us, it's working three jobs. But, you know, for someone else, and even for us now, we're getting, we're making things. This is the creative class. So people are making things. They're selling what they're making. It's all about the side hustle. And only now the side hustle is getting real because people aren't necessarily able to make it work with their one job. Mm-hmm. Now, in The End of Jobs, what this guy is talking about is essentially creating a bridge from where you are to where you want to be. Mm-hmm. And so you use your corporate experience really as a kind of internship. You are collecting skill sets. You're collecting a knowledge base that you can then segue into the next thing and the next thing to put you where in business. Mm-hmm. We're going back into an entrepreneurial economy. Once upon a time, this nation's working class were actually people that worked for themselves. It was a shopkeeper, a butcher, a baker, a candlestick maker, literally. And so you actually fraternized and interacted with other entrepreneurs. They just didn't couch it in those terms. Mm-hmm. So the language has gotten sexier, but the concept is really no different. Only the game is changing. They're polishing the game. So you're taking your knowledge, you're taking your wisdom, you're taking your corporate experience, and you're positioning yourself to go into business. You make a bunch of money or a little money in a particular business. What do? You get into you accumulate enough skills and wisdom to get into yet
move on to something else.
Another business, not necessarily another job.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I completely agree. And Nancy, part of what you're talking about, USA Today actually had an article. If I'm not mistaken, it was last Friday, that said 50% of Americans who are currently employed by, don't quote me on a year, but sure, I think it was 2020, will also have an entrepreneurial endeavor.
Okay.
And that's being sourced by something.
Yes.
And what it's being sourced by is the switching era, right? So we're in the information age now. Information age is quickly coming to a close. And after that, I believe it will be the robotic age. But what has really forced the information age is the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And the internet has introduced what is called by some microeconomics. And the industrial revolution introduced macroeconomics, right?
Okay.
Let me give you a quick example. So if I like banana pancakes in a macroeconomic world, right? Like we can go back to the 1980s.
Yes.
The only way I could get banana pancakes was to take the Betty Crocker pancake mix that was mass produced and buy it in a grocery store and then cut up bananas and put it in that mix.
Right.
Otherwise, my grandmother had to make it from scratch, right? Those were your two options.
Exactly.
Now, today, I could get online and look up pre-made banana pancake mix. And there is someone out there who has a 5-star rating, and I could purchase it from them no matter where they are in the nation, sometimes the world, and get that from them. So what is that doing? If I'm buying my banana pancake mix from this person now, that is money that Target, some of these other grocery
giant
entities,
Safeway, they're not getting it.
Kroger, Safeway, et cetera, are no longer getting. And you take me and you begin to multiply that by other people who want their type of pancake mix, and that is eroding the macroeconomic structure.
Mm.
And because it's eroding the macroeconomic structure, business results are no longer what they used to be. And that means the business results are no longer what they used to be. There are fewer jobs.
Okay.
And that is what's pushing us towards entrepreneurship.
Okay. Okay, I can totally get that. I was wondering how, you know, we had a woman on, Patricia Chelya, about permaculture. And one of the questions, I don't know if we even got to ask, was how do you get arrested for growing your own food? And I thought to myself, I said, well, Nancy, if you grew food in your backyard and all you did was give it away to the people in your neighborhood, you could cause a 2-5% drop in the sale of produce at Safeway. Mm-hmm. Safeway is going to want to know, why are we not buying as much produce as we used to, or why is it going bad? If they can source it to you, you could get arrested.
Yep.
Do you have a permit to grow produce?
Isn't that crazy? And wait a minute, and give it away. Mm. You may not even be selling it.
Yeah, the giving it away.
But I realized that could actually it creates a problem. If it creates a problem for a big business who's employing people, who's providing benefits and all of that stuff, then I could see how it would at least cause you a little bit of trouble. how you could get yourself into a little bit of trouble. Because these companies, on the way to their profits going down, they're doing what they can to fight back. Some of them are swallowing up the smaller companies.
Did you have any opportunity to be macho, or, you know, to demonstrate any machismo other than at the tug of war concert, the tug of war contest at the annual picnic?
I kept that to a minimum. I kept that to a minimum. As a matter of fact, often I would take a loss in a meeting. I would take a knock, so that for me it was the end game. I had my eyes set on where I wanted to be, and one of the pieces of advice I was going to give is that when we opened the show, I said vision. Mm-hmm. My vision was I wanted to go to the next level. I wanted to learn more. I wanted to be exposed to more. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, when there were opportunities for me to win and kind of beat my chest, often I would remain mute because I knew that that would have a cataclysmic impact on my brand if I beat my chest.
On your brand. Interesting.
Yeah, on my brand.
Yeah. So you remained humble.
Humble, always.
Okay.
If I won, I act like I was surprised. If I was in a meeting where I was questioned over and over again, and at the end there were no more questions, and it looked like what I was, in some way, the business case I was providing was about to go through and be approved, I would act surprised. Like, oh, wow, well, thank you so much for your consideration, right? Now, mind you, I've been up since, you know, maybe three nights in a row making sure that this would be approved, right? I knew it would be approved.
That it would be a fait
accompli.
But
when I got the win in public, it was shock, thank you, humbleness. And if I was going to beat my chest, I did it at home.
Okay. You're listening to Frank Relationships, and we're talking with former Vice President and Chief Diversity Officer, Lenal Harris. We're discussing corporate America, particularly as a black male. Lenal is also a certified life coach and global entrepreneur. Good night. What's going on?
Get it together, Frank. No more drinking.
Global entrepreneur. Please tell us what you're up to and how we can find you.
So, you know, what I'm up to is I'm a radio host and a life coach.
Okay, where's speaker. your radio host where?
For WBON 1690 AM, the Talk of Chicago, based here in Chicago. You can check us out via the iHeart app on your smartphone. Mm-hmm. And you can also find me at Lenal Harris. The first name is spelled L-I-N-A-L. You can find me at Lenal Harris on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, Periscope. You know, you name it, I'm out there.
Okay. And what about your coaching? How can we get tapped into that part of what you're up to?
So if you want to find out more about coaching, you can go to www.lenalharris. And you can also find my coaching organization called Insight for Life, the number 4, on Facebook. And follow us there.
Do you have a bachelor's or a master's?
I don't.
Neither.
Now,
how in the world did you rise through the ranks without a degree? And I guess I didn't ask about an associate's, but without a bachelor's.
I do have an associate.
Okay.
But I'll tell you, one of the things I identified about corporate America is that the people who go to the really, really smart universities, and if you see me, I'm doing air quotes, aren't always smart. And I realized this probably early on. When I first got into corporate America, I was coupled up with a guy who had graduated from Cornell. So imagine me, here I have my associate's degree from junior college here in Chicago, and I'm coupled up with a kid that, you know, just got out of Cornell. And man, I felt inferior. Mm-hmm. There's no other way to explain it, right? Mm-hmm. Over time, I began to realize that he wasn't that smart. And And I said, wow, okay, he's not really that smart. So he must be book smart. He got through his tests and things at Cornell. But when it comes to really understanding the business and solving problems, like, it's difficult for him, where I found it to be easy for me. So what I did is I began to identify ways that I could provide exponential value to my leaders and to the organization. So what problem do they currently have that I can solve that no one else can solve? What project do they have that everyone is avoiding that I can take on because I trust my ability to successfully deliver on that project? Mm-hmm. And so I basically started taking all the garbage. And over time, I became very valuable to my leaders. And I used that value as leverage to move into roles of leadership. Basically saying, literally saying, once, and now I'm going to be very clear, once I had established a value, and timing is very important, right? Knowing that maybe we're going into a new year, we have 4 to 5 projects, of which I'm a key player in all the projects. Right when they place me in the positions of value, that's when I will go to my leader and say, I've really been wanting to move into that leadership role. So, you know, at the time when I wasn't a supervisor, I waited for that and mm-hmm. said, I would really like to be a supervisor. And I got the role. You know, and I was told, well, normally we want someone to have a bachelor's degree. Why don't you go ahead and take the role? We'll figure out how to get you back in school. Okay. Now, as I started looking at larger roles, right, senior manager, director, I would hear the same thing, and I would just wait until the stakes were extremely high. I would position myself with projects of value and basically say, you know, that director role is open now. I believe I've proven myself. And I did get passed over. Mm-hmm. And how I end up breaking through the ranks of senior manager into director is, the organization I was with at the time, I actually threatened to leave. Mm. And because I was a key player and I had positioned myself the way I had positioned myself, you know, that kind of made them panic. Mm. And as soon as the position came open again, they promoted me. Believe me, I don't think they necessarily wanted to. Mm-hmm. But the work I was doing had placed me in a position of leverage where they felt like they had to in order to keep.
On the relationship side, you touch on something I wrote about many years ago, and that was the need, mm-hmm. the importance of bringing value. I have a belief, and that's you don't need, quote unquote, a commitment from a partner if you're bringing value continually. You don't need a person to say, I will forever and ever do this if you are bringing them value regularly. And
absolutely,
that is what I that what you just said reminds me of that conversation that I had with Pen and Pad years ago. In an effort to make sure we touch some romantic relationship issue here on this particular show, I'm kind of throwing that in there. And it also,
I like it.
It fits. It's real.
Yeah, because we tend to only concern ourselves in the direct sense with where we're bringing value professionally. Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily think about it in those terms.
Yeah.
In relationship.
Yeah.
But I like that. I think that's a great segue into the second thing that made me successful.
Hit it. Right?
And that is my ability to build strong relationships with some of the people that matter, very strategic relationships with leaders and people of influence within the companies I work for. Mm-hmm. So when I look for individuals that seem to have some type of affinity for me. Mm-hmm. And if they were in a position of leadership and influence, I grew that relationship. Mm-hmm. I figured out what it was that I was doing that could provide value to them. I thought about their work. I would follow up with them and say, hey, that project you're on, last night I was thinking about it. What do you think about this? Would this enhance your project? And as a result, I gained their loyalty. And in gaining their loyalty, when they would hear things about me that were negative, when they would hear things that they felt like I needed to know, again, remembering that, you know, as a black man in corporate America, there's a lot being said about you that you will never hear to your face. Mm-hmm. And so they would come to me and say, hey, watch out over here. Watch out for that person, this, that, and the other. I can't say that it was just me bringing value to projects that helped me be successful. Mm-hmm. It was also those type of conversations that helped me navigate around my enemies. Mm-hmm. Because you will have enemies. I use that word very deliberately.
You're nailing this. Like, hey, remember the show we did with Verna?
Yes, he was mesmerized. He just listened.
I'm not a, if you guys don't know, I'm not the corporate dude.
No.
So to
by design.
Yeah, by design.
Yeah.
To hear what you're saying and to look at the complexities of it, and particularly as it relates to the street side of things, like they very much go hand in hand.
I think corporate culture was actually modeled off of mafia family.
Mm, okay.
Business.
And on another note, Linnell, do you watch Power?
I do. I do. Love that show.
Do you watch it, Nancy?
I've only seen it maybe once or twice.
I've watched the most recent episode and I've really enjoyed the show. At the end of last season, I thought I was going to put it away because the end of the season ended in a way that I thought was just dumb with 50 and Ghost having a fist fight are you serious? These guys are they are two murderers. Like right. They kill people.
So they obviously don't want to kill each other.
Well, no, one had the drop on the other.
Okay.
And didn't kill him. It was absurd. It was like an excuse to just bring the character back next year.
Okay.
Well, that character 50 is just still in the mix. It's kind of stupid the way he's still in the mix with Ghost's son and it's the drama in it is building to the point of it's almost absurdity at this point. And I would love to, I was thinking to myself, what would I like to see? And at some level, I'd like to see Ghost dealing with more of those club scenes. You know, he's dealing with the conflict with the club as a club across the street. He's getting further into corporate stuff, or at least business stuff.
Which is what he wants, right?
Which is what he wants. Yeah. And I'd like to see more of that because a lot of he's got street stuff coming at him from every direction. I mean, it is really becoming too much as far as I'm concerned, to the point where it's just like a soap opera. But
I guess he could use what he's learned.
Well, he is using
in the streets.
Yeah. Oh, he is using it. He's using that, what he learned in the streets, in his, you know, club game. Yeah. And I think that's a really good example of what I'm saying. I think often because I showed up with the glasses, speaking like this, good morning, everyone.
Right.
That they felt like, you know, this dude is soft. Like, man, I can play him.
Uh-huh. Mm.
And I would see it coming a mile away, and I wouldn't say anything. And when the timing was right, that's when that peer, that leader, that colleague who I knew was an enemy, who had been after me, when the timing was right, that's when I played my card. And often they would be looking confused, but how did he win? Because I never beat my chest.
Mm-hmm.
How did he win as they walked out the door or as they were fired? Like, how did he win?
Wow.
And it was simply patience and always watching and also keeping them very close. Mm-hmm. I know you don't like me, but I'm always at your desk saying, hey, so again, on this project, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And I know what you're saying is incredible. I know that you're trying to mislead me. And if I can get you to send me that email so that way I can prove that you were an impediment to this project, I got you.
Wow.
And that's how I played the game.
It's called the Wayne Brady theory.
The Wayne Brady theory.
You know, I never saw Wayne ever cash in, though.
You ever watch Let's Make a Deal?
Is that the show he's
yeah,
a co-host?
He's a game show host.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. He's America's sweetheart.
Yeah.
Is he really?
But I mean,
though?
He just remains America's sweetheart. He never seems to just
say,
you know.
Chappelle's show he let go once.
and he came home. Once on Chappelle's show. I think we saw the real Wayne.
Really? Really? You think that was
I don't think that was a joke. I think the real Wayne for the first time on the Chappelle show.
Wow. I thought it was just so Dave Chappelle did a show basically where he had Wayne Brady riding around doing drive-bys.
But more to the point, on a more serious level, there's a horrible movie that came out, I think, in the 70s, which is good learning. It's called The Spook Who Sat by the Door.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I just actually watched it a couple weeks ago because Herbie Hancock did the music, and the music's awesome. Mm-hmm. So it's very dated. Mm-hmm. But African-American men, anyone actually, getting into business, corporate business, should see that. Good lessons.
Whoa.
Yep.
Okay. Oh, man.
We need a part two on this one.
Yeah. So for those of you who did not hear the show about Verna, what was Verna Mastin?
Verna Mastin.
Verna was a former, she's a former
madam.
Madam. And I sat at
listen
that.
Listen to him.
Man, the show blew my mind. It was a incredible, the content, what she brought, the different perspective, her different experiences were incredible. So I urge you, check that show out. Check it out. And if we have so fortunate to do a part two of this one, check that one out too. Anyway, oh man. You've been listening to Frank Relationships, and we've been talking with former Vice President and Chief Diversity Officer Lanelle Harris. We've been discussing corporate...
Sorry.
You said it right.
I had to dig into him. I owed him one from the last show.
We've been discussing corporate America, particularly for black men. Lanelle is a certified life coach and global entrepreneur. So one more time, please tell us what you're up to and how we can find you.
So what I'm up to is currently I'm a certified ontological coach. I coach executives, entrepreneurs, athletes, and you can find me at Lanelle Harris on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, Periscope, most of the social mediums. And also you can find me on Facebook at Inspirational Perspective. And you can also check out the radio show, the talk show, on WVON 1690 AM, the Talk of Chicago, on Saturday evenings at 10 p.m. via the iHeart app if you're not in Chicago.
Along today's journey, we've discussed college and whether you actually need to be a college graduate in order to rise up in the ranks in corporate life, quiet strength. We didn't call it that, but it's certainly one of the things that we touched on, and fitting in, and when to leave when you're not fitting in, when it isn't working for you. Thank you to my co-host, Nancy. Thanks to Jeff Newman, my engineer, and thank you to my incredible guest, Lanelle Harris. You've been great.
More than welcome.
I hope you've had as much fun as I've had hanging out with today's ensemble, as always. It's my wish for you to walk away from this conversation with a heaping helping of useful information that'll help you create a relationship that's as loving and accepting as possible. Let us know what you thought of today's show at Facebook.com/RelationshipFLove, on Twitter at Mr. That's M.R. Frank Love, or at franklove.com. If you're listening via Blog Talk Radio, make sure you like us there. And if via iTunes, make sure you subscribe so that you can receive each week's show. This is Frank Love.